Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 11, Text 25. Okay. Strinam chapati devanam. Tachushro shanukulata. Tachushro shanukulata. Tadbandhu shvanu vritischa. Nichamta vratadadanam. Strinam chapati devanam. Tachusru sanukulata. Tadbandhu shvanu vritischa. Nityam tad vratadaranam. Strinam chapati devanam. Tachusru sanukulata. Tad bandushvanu vritischa. Nityam tad vratadaranam. Please. Strinam, of women. Cha, also. Pati devanam, who have accepted their husbands as worshipable. Tat srushusha, readiness to render service to her husband. Anukulata, being favorably disposed towards her husband. Tat bandhushu, unto the friends and relatives of the husband. Anuvriti, being similarly disposed to treat them well for the satisfaction of the husband. Cha and nityam regularly. Tat vratadharanam, accepting the vows of the husband or acting exactly as the husband acts. Okay, translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. To render service to the husband, to be always favorably disposed toward the husband, to be equally well disposed toward the husband's relatives and friends, and to follow the vows of the husband. These are the four principles to be followed by women described as chaste. Purport. It is very important for peaceful householder life that a woman follow the vow of her husband. Any disagreement with the husband's vow will disrupt family life. In this regard, Chanaka Pandit gives a very valuable instruction. Tampat yo kalaho nasti tatrashri svayam agata. When there are no fights between husband and wife, the goddess of fortune automatically comes to the home. A woman's education should be conducted along the lines indicated in this verse. The basic principle for a chaste woman is to be always favorably disposed toward her husband. In the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 1, text 40, it is said, Strishu dusteshu varshneya jayate vanasankara. If women are polluted, there will be vanasankara population. In modern terms, the vanasankara are the hippies, who do not follow any regulative injunctions. Another explanation is that when the population is vanasankara, no one can know who is on what platform. The Varnashram system scientifically divides society into four varnas and four ashrams. But in vanasankara society, there are no such distinctions. No one can know who is who. In such a society, no one can distinguish between a brahmana, a kshatriya, a vaishya, and a sudra. For peace and happiness in the material world, the Varnashram institution must be introduced. The symptoms of one's activities must be defined, and one must be educated accordingly. Then spiritual advancement will automatically be possible. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Ita Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Govardhavani Pacharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacharya Shacharine. I think a good idea would be to just kind of work through this purport sentence by sentence and kind of, you know, try to analyze what Prabhupada's saying here, what he's, you know, what he's getting at. So the first sentence is Prabhupada says, it is very important for peaceful household life that a woman follow the vow of her husband. So what's being spoken about here in this purport is peaceful household life. So basically, Prabhupada's referring to grihastha ashram, as opposed to like a grihamedi situation. And I'm going to try to, talk about this in such a way that it's how it, applicable to us. I'm sure, relevant to us. There's probably a broader application, but I'm not going to try to talk about that. I'm just going to try to talk about how it is, relates to us. Okay, so peaceful household life, it's important that a woman follow the vow of her husband. Any disagreement with the husband's vow will disrupt family life. Okay, well, I mean, the vows that all the devotees take in the Krishna conscious movement are at the time of initiation, no illicit sex, no meeting, no intoxication, no gambling. And if the woman is not agreeable to follow the vow of the husband, of course she takes those vows too. The basic idea is this, well, of course, this, the text and the purport are talking about women, but I'd like to make the point that it's kind of applicable both ways. It holds true both ways, that it's the woman has to follow the vow of the husband, and the husband has to follow the vow of the woman, in the sense that if the woman is a devotee and she's also taken vows, at the time of initiation, no illicit sex, no meeting, no intoxication, no gambling, the husband has to be prepared to go along with that. And Prabhupada points out, he quotes Chanaka Pandit, that what'll happen. Actually, quotes Chanaka Pandit, a statement that when there's no fights between the husband and wife, the goddess of fortune automatically comes to the home. And the idea there is this, that if you follow these vows, you're in the mode of goodness. And of course, well, one point is that you're in more than mode of goodness. You're pleasing. You're pleasing your spiritual master. When you follow the instructions of a spiritual master, you're pleasing the spiritual master. When you're pleasing the spiritual master, Krishna's pleased. And when Krishna's pleased, he reciprocates. He bestows his blessings or his benedictions upon the devotees he's pleased with. And that's why that's the explanation behind when there's no fights between the husband and the wife, the goddess of fortune automatically comes to the home. Because when Vishnu's pleased, Lakshmi's pleased. And so you're going to be, you know, the householder couple that follows their vows, you know, and doesn't fight, will be blessed by Lakshmi Devi. Because the spiritual master's pleased, the spiritual master's pleased, Vishnu's pleased, and Vishnu's pleased, she's pleased. And if they don't follow the rules and regulations, or the vows, then what happens is you're contacting the mode of passion. And just the nature of the mode of passion is that you're going to fight. That's like one of the symptoms of people in the mode of passion. You know, like Kali Yuga is referred to the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. It's just like a symptom of people who are influenced by the modes of passion, ignorance, and that they quarrel. It doesn't even matter if there's anything worth quarreling about. It's just because you're influenced by that modes of nature, you're going to quarrel, whether it's about anything, whatever it's about, not enough money or whatever. You're in that mood. You know, like there's an expression, oh, that guy's got a chip on his shoulder. So if somebody's got a chip on their shoulder, it doesn't matter what you do, what you say, that person's got a chip on their shoulder, they're going to get into an argument with you about it. See, so that's how it works. You're contacting that mode of nature when you, it's like when you come out of like, there's that example, real quick, that in the Ramayana, when Sita wanted Lakshman to go after the deer, because she thought Ram was in danger. She, you know, Maricha was called out, Lakshman, help! Everyone knows the story. So he said, okay, he didn't want to go because Ram specifically instructed him, no, you have to stay here and protect Sita. But then Sita accused him of being a coward. She accused him of, you know, wanting to take advantage of the situation to enjoy with her, like that. So Lakshman, against his better judgment, really, he didn't really want to, but he agreed, okay, I'll go. I'll go see what's, you know, see if Ram's in trouble, if he needs my help. But before he went, he said, okay, look, I'm going to draw this circle around you, and you stay within, as long as you stay within this circle, you're okay, you're protected. But if you go outside the circle, then you're not protected. So it's kind of like that. And of course, she went outside the circle. Ravana came and he tricked her to go outside the circle, and that's how he was able to kidnap her. But the idea is that the instructions, it's an analogy. The instructions of the spiritual master, they're like that protective circle. And as long as we stay with inside that, you know, the instructions of the spiritual master, as long as we're following the instructions of the spiritual master, we're protected. You're protected, you know. And as soon as you step outside, as soon as you stop following the instructions of the spiritual master, Maya will just come and snatch you up. You know, you're not protected. You lose that protection. See? So if you deviate from the vows, you know, that the husband makes or the wife makes or the both devotees make, then you're fair game. You're prey. You're fair game for Maya, and she'll come in, you know, and you'll be influenced by Maya, and then that's the result will be quarreling. Prabhupada says here, he goes going further in the purport, a woman's education should be conducted along the lines indicated in this verse. The basic principle for a chaste woman is to be always favorably disposed to her husband. Okay, so the idea is that, like in the Vedic culture, you know, how it worked was the man's the leader, you know, and the woman was supposed to follow. And it's not exploitation. It's, you know, that's the Vedic understanding of the human form of life, that, you know, they're both, you know, human beings, and they're both working cooperatively, and they're both trying to go back to Godhead. But the male body is such that, you know, and Prabhupada mentions this in the third canto and in one of the purports there, that he, you know, that the psychology is such that the man feels, you know, he wants to be the leader, and the woman, you know, psychologist, she should follow. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with that as long as the man is qualified. See, that point will come up here in a couple verses ahead. Prabhupada, you know, there's a whole, it doesn't stop there. There's a whole, you know, it's women are feeling like, wow, why are they leaning on us? You know, we got to do this and we got to do that and we got to do this. So I'll just read a few more. It says here, a chaste woman must dress nicely, decorate herself with golden ornaments for the pleasure of her husband, always wearing clean and attractive garments. She should sweep and clean the household with water and other liquids so that the entire house is always pure and clean. She should collect the household paraphernalia and keep the house always aromatic with incense and flowers, and must be ready to execute the desires of her husband. And the women might be sitting here thinking, God, give me a break. I mean, you know, this is like, well, what about the men? You know, everything. And it goes on. Being modest and truthful, controlling her senses, and speaking in sweet words, a chaste woman should engage in the service of her husband with love according to the time and circumstances. It goes on. A chaste woman should not be greedy, but satisfied in all circumstances. She must be very expert in handling household affairs, and should be fully conversant with religious principles. She should speak pleasingly and truthfully, and should be very careful and always clean and pure. Thus, a chaste woman should engage with affection in the service of a husband. And here it comes, the women, get ready, okay? Who is not fallen? See, that's the caveat. That's the point. If the husband is not fallen, it's okay. You know, everybody's got to follow somebody, you know. We're all following somebody. We're all, you know, kind of following the direction of some higher personality. So in the Vedic culture, it's in proper human society, we should say, the women are following the men, but, you know, who are not fallen. In other words, the men are qualified. You know, they're not debauchees. It's not like the woman's doing all this stuff and the husband's sitting in back there at the house and he's lying on the couch, you know, the classic thing with lying on the couch and dropping grapes into his mouth, you know, and while the woman's doing running around doing all this stuff. No, it's not like that. You know, the men have their responsibilities too. And I remember one thing that really got me when the first time I went to India, when we were driving in the bus from the airport to, I guess it was to Mayapur or maybe it was to Vrindavan, I can't remember. And we went through some towns or cities on the way. And I was looking out, you know, you look out the window and I see, okay, well, oh, yeah, look, there's a lot of men. Where's all the women? This is back in like 19, you know, maybe it's changed already. I don't know. Everything's changing. But at least in the late 70s, early 80s, when you drive, you know, from the airport to either Mayapur or Vrindavan, and you pass through certain cities, and you don't see very many women. At least you used to not see very many women on the street because that was the Vedic culture. The women stayed at home. You know, the man had responsibilities. He had to earn a livelihood. That's no joke. You know, all those, I mean, like, at least 90% of the human bodies I was seeing were male human bodies. So in other words, the men are out there, like, you know, hustling, going for it. They're all out there trying to earn a living. And it's competitive, and it's like an austerity. And it's like, it's, you know, like, and somebody, a woman might, upon hearing these things, might go, as I said, give me a break. That's a lot of, you know, responsibility. It's a lot of austerity. Yeah, but it wasn't like one-sided. It wasn't lopsided. The men had those types of things, too. The man had to get out there and compete and deal with all these other men. And, you know, they had a lot on their shoulders, too. So it's kind of like, you know, it's a balance. So that's there. And, yeah, so the man has to not be fallen. It's okay to follow if the man is not fallen. If a woman has a husband who's, a pukka devotee, responsible person, then that's good. Follow. That's the nature of the thing. That's the way just like from a cow you get. Everybody's body is different. You know, no two bodies are the same, you know. So the male body is meant for, like, earning the livelihood, protecting. You know, there's certain roles that just kind of come along with that male body, and there's certain roles. This is not my opinion. I'm just talking. It's my understanding what the scriptures say. There's certain roles that are just, you know, part of the equipment of the female body. Just like, you know, you hop in a certain kind of vehicle, it comes equipped with certain things. See, the cow body comes equipped with the ability to give milk. The elephant body comes equipped with the ability to, you know, load it up with a bunch of stuff. And the female body comes equipped with certain qualities. The male body comes equipped with certain qualities. That's like Krishna's design, Krishna's arrangement. And it's, once again, it's okay to just follow that as long as if the man is not fallen. And getting back to that point about we're all following somebody, like in the Vedic culture, the woman is supposed to follow the qualified, the not fallen husband. The not fallen husband is supposed to follow the spiritual master or the Brahmin, right? The spiritual master is supposed to follow Krishna, and Krishna, at least in some circumstances, in Goloka Vrindavan, he has to follow Radharani. So it all comes back. Now, that's an attempt at a joke, but it all equals out. In other words, like, there's no harm in following somebody if they're actually more qualified than you, if they actually, you know, That's the way it goes. I mean, even Bob Dylan acknowledged that. There was one song Bob Dylan wrote, "You got to serve somebody," something like that. You know, it's a principle. It's just like it's a principle of human social interaction that you serve somebody who's kind of like superior to yourself, and it's okay as long as they're, you know, once again, not form qualified. So now, next point, I'm going to try to say a little bit more about that, but I just want to work my way through this purport here first. Then Prabhupada points out what the result will be if the says the basic principle for a chaste woman is to be always favorably disposed towards her husband. And then it goes here in the you got to like read these purports carefully, because there's a tendency, you know, you read it and then you read the next sentence. It's like, but there's a Prabhupada, sometimes there's the whole change in the current of thought. Like here, listen to this now. It says in the Bhagavad Gita 140, it is said, "Strisu dusteshu varshnaya jayate vanasankara." If the women are polluted, there will be vanasankara population. And this is Prabhupada's kind of like, you got to really think of, whoa, wait, he just shifted from a whole thing to a whole other thing. In modern terms, the vanasankara are the hippies who do not follow any regulative injunctions. Another explanation is that when the population is vanasankara, no one can know who is on what platform. Okay, so just on this point of the vanasankara, somebody might just, most probably all the devotees pretty much are aware of this, but just in case you're not, how that works is this, that, okay, so the woman's not faithful, she's not chaste, and she's has a relationship with another man. But how does that produce vanasankara population? You know, to an ordinary person off the street, they would just think, okay, you get population. I mean, you know, what's the big deal? You know, she has a certain genetic makeup, and that, so that genetic makeup will combine with the genetic makeup of the person she combines, you know, has relationships with, and that'll produce the children. And why should they be any, you know, that much inferior to children that are produced as a result of her combining with her husband? Well, that's the modern material biological understanding, but we have a different understanding how that determines, you know, the Vedic understanding of what determines what kind of living entity appears as a result of a combination of man and woman is completely different. We're working with a consciousness-based model or consciousness-based worldview or understanding of life and reality, as opposed to a material-based worldview. And I'll explain what I'm talking about. My understanding is that the consciousness of the husband and the wife at the time of conception, that's what determines the living entity that's attracted to that situation, you know, to the womb. See, it's not like genetic makeup's a factor, but this other idea is there, you know, that the consciousness of the husband, that's what I always was taught and heard as a devotee growing up in Krishna consciousness, that the consciousness of the husband and the wife at the time of conception is a very significant factor in determining who winds up there. It's not just, you know, the genetic combination of the two genetic makeups, you see? So this is what happens, that, you know, so when somebody's engaging in illicit sex, obviously their consciousness is not going to be very divine, so you're not going to attract, you know, very elevated, spiritually elevated divine personalities, to say the least, you know? So that's where the Vanasankara population comes in. It's the consciousness is, you know, it produces a result of illicit sex, bad, bad consciousness, and then getting living entities that are, you know, sort of like that their karmic destiny is to appear in that those types of situations. So they're not going to help human society. And, you know, they're not going to help with the progressive, you know, movement of human society towards, you know, achieving spiritual goals. So that's that point. And then Prabhupada, last few sentences, he talks about how as a result of the Vanasankara population, everything becomes topsy-turvy. You know, you can't make a distinction between who's a Brahmin, who's a Kshatriya, who's a Vaishya, who's a Sudra. And you know, it kind of messes everything up. And I couldn't think of a really good example to illustrate that point. Maybe in the question and answer period, somebody might be able to come up with one. But I think everybody can appreciate just in general that if you have a, you know, situation like that where you kind of like, you don't, it's confusing. You know, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be confusing. It's going to be, what's the other word? Inefficient. You know, when you don't know who to go to for guidance, who to go to for protection, who to go for to for resources, et cetera, or for just like assistance, it's going to be confusing and inefficient. So that's in that way, this, you know, the social system breaks down. Once again, I wish I had a like kind of example that just kind of crystallized the whole thing, but I couldn't think of one. Okay, so now going on this point of being qualified, this is supported in other places in the in the Vedic literatures. For instance, in the Bhagavatam, there's that verse. Maybe somebody knows the Sanskrit, I don't know, but he says, you know, you shouldn't try to be a father, you shouldn't try to be a teacher, you shouldn't try to be anything, a demigod or a worshipful, you know, unless you can deliver your dependent from the, you know, repetition of birth and death. So that's the instruction by Lord Rishabhdev. Somebody knows the Sanskrit for that one? Yeah. So, you know, that's a very famous verse, instruction by Lord Rishabhdev. So, you know, emphasizing, that confirming that point, that unless you're qualified, don't do it. Don't go there, you see? And somebody might ask the question, well, why would you? You know, why would somebody go there, you know, even if they're not qualified? Why would somebody become a father or a teacher or this or that, even if they're not qualified? Well, the answer is that for false prestige. You see, in the material world, there's gross material sense gratification and there's subtle material sense gratification. Subtle material sense gratification is the desires for profit, adoration, and distinction. And in human society, that's also, you know, very prominent. You know, people want profit, they want to be honored. Prabhupada says in some place in the Bhagavad Gita, people want to be honored or respected as being like a religious person without necessarily having the qualifications. So that's a contamination, that to want to, you know, enjoy that subtle sense gratification of being honored, respected like that. But so devotees have to be on guard against that. You know, we have to be on guard against that weed or contamination entering into our own consciousness. As devotees, we should desire to be respectable, but not respected. There's a difference. That's, we should desire to be, devotees should be, his meditation should be, how can I conduct my life, how can I live my life in such a way that I'm respectable, I'm the kind of person that commands respect. Not that, you know, devotees shouldn't be trying to work out different ways and kind of come up with, you know, situations how he's going to be respected. So it's like there's a difference. And if you meditate it, you know, it becomes more and more obvious what that is. So the consequence of not doing that, the consequence of not being following these guidelines, you know, we get all sorts of guidelines. This is a whole chapter of giving us guidelines of, you know, how the woman should behave, how the man should behave, how the sudra should behave. I'm coming in towards the end of the chapter, but, you know, there's a lot of these guidelines here. These guidelines are important to follow because, you know, even for what to speak of for advancement in spiritual life, even for material life, the, you know, guidelines are important to follow. And what happens is if we don't follow the guidelines, We're the losers. You know, individually and even collect and on a societal level, we're the losers. I'll give you, this is a, you know, common day expression. When you abuse, you lose. You see? And that's how it works. When you don't follow the guidelines, you lose. I'll just give you a couple of, like, really simple examples off the top of my head that, you know, there's probably better examples and certainly more examples. But, like, you know, now, like, one problem that's in contemporary human society, and we've had it in ISKCON too, is child abuse. Okay? Just over the, I don't remember hearing anything, even hearing about child abuse as I was a kid growing up. I don't think I even heard of that until about like 20 years ago or something like that. Yet, like, you know, child abuse? What, I mean, somebody, just like, what? I never even, but anyway, so now it's a problem. Not only within ISKCON it was a problem, hopefully it's taken, you know, under control now, and it's a problem in society at large. So what's the result of that? You can't play with kids. See, one of the most fun things, you know, playing with kids, no adult, you know, who's careful about, I don't play with kids. I'm not going to play with kids because it's too dangerous now. You know, somebody thinks, accuses you of, oh, this guy, I know, I saw so-and-so play with so-and-so. I'm not sure about that. You know, you can't play with kids anymore. So once again, you know, when you abuse, you lose. This is an example. Like, so now the whole quality of life has kind of been pulled down a notch because of, you know, misuse of that. Not by everybody, just by some people. Another example is terrorism. You know, of course, it's, you know, causes leading up to these things. You can't. But anyway, terrorism. So some small percentage of individuals have, you know, chose to respond to different social pressures and things like that by engaging in terroristic activities. And everybody's paying the price, not just, you know, the actual act itself, but like now when you go to, I'll give you the example, is when you go to the airport. Flying used to be a pleasure. It used to be a pleasure to just rock up to the airport, you know, with your boarding pass and just kind of go through the security, just throw a few things on the, you know, on the whatever you call it there, the conveyor belt, and then zoop, you go right into the, and you bring your friends with you, and you sit around, and you could talk, and, you know, you do, yeah, it's like, it was a pleasure. Flying was a pleasure. And now it's a torture, at least for me. It's nearly, it's practically on borderline torture. I hate it. Sorry. I hate when I have to fly someplace, because you got to go there, and there's this big, long line for security, because everybody's got to take off their shoes and empty their pockets and all this kind of stuff, you know? And it's just, and they treat you hard, you know, they treat you like guilty until proven innocent kind of thing. You know, it's a whole mood there of like, we don't know that you're not a terrorist. Prove that you're not a terrorist. It's like horrible, you know, and it's kind of the whole thing has been not totally spoiled, but it really kind of changed the whole thing. Once again, an example. And another example, this is like more kind of coming home to our little circle of activities. This morning I saw Rabindranath and greeting the deities. So I was looking at the back of his head. Not, you know, I just happened to look at the back of his head. After, and I noticed that he had a little seeker like everybody, but he had a big, like a kind of a large patch there. So Rabindranath is, you know, I know he's like very careful about rules and regulations. So I thought I'm going to just, you know, needle him. I'm tease him a bit just for the heck of it, you know. He's friends. We're friends. So I said, hey, Rabindranath, I said, you know, I read that if you have a seeker, it's supposed to be an inch and a half in diameter. And if it's bigger than that, that's an other sampradaya. So I did. I just read that the other day, and I read it in the Lilamrita, and the person was quoting Prabhupada. So I said that to him, but he got like, I didn't know how he was going to react, but he got kind of like annoyed, you know. He said, where is that in the Shastra? I said, well, I just read it in the Lilamrita. And he goes, I don't accept that. I said, but, you know, it was Prabhupada was being quoted as having said it. He said, I don't accept it. He said, look, the BBT won't even reprint the Lilamrita. Is that a fact? Anyway, that's what he said to me. So I thought to myself, that's like another example. You know, unfortunately, as a result of, you know, problems that the author of the Lilamrita had, it puts the whole, you know, the integrity of the entire work into question. It's like an example. If you abuse, you lose. You know, now like the whole, it would be a shame if the Lilamrita is now, you know, not something that devotees years to come don't read, because it's, everybody's all concerned that, well, who knows was it really accurate, or it's contaminated by this and that because the author was in bad conscience. So it's like, you know, once again, an example of when you abuse, you lose. It's really important to follow follow these guidelines. And another point is that, you know, we might be thinking that if, like, we deviate that, okay, well, anyway, it's just me. But it doesn't work like that. You know, I remember when I was a kid in school, I won't go into that. But we're all affecting each other. You know, like when somebody, especially the longer you've been around and the higher position you're in, if you deviate, and you, it's not just you're affected for sure, but you're really affecting the lives of a lot of other people. You affect the lives of a lot of other devotees, and probably you get reaction for that, I imagine, as well. You know, so it's really like a very important, serious thing, and no one should. And the GBC kind of like, anyway, this understanding of this even at the very, very highest levels. I was reading yesterday, I was just looking up something on the internet, and I just came across this one GBC resolution where it was making the point, I couldn't find it a second time when I wanted to actually copy it down word for word. But the point it was making that was a guru is a guru as long as he's like in, you know, following properly. But if a guru stops, even to the level of guru, it was making the point that if a guru stops following properly, then, he's not like he's even that when you come to that level, you know, you're disconnected, you're cutting yourself off, you're not considering, like, you're not like an instrument or a medium for the, you know, for the flow of the mercy or the potency of the disciplic section to come through you. Once you if you deviate, if you stop following the rules and regulations that are for a devotee and a guru, so nobody should be thinking like they have an irrevocable right to respect and this and that. You know, it's anyway. So these once again, these points are there that these guidelines are there. They're for our benefit. You know, they're not just to kind of make our lives more difficult and less fun. They're there to help us get purified and elevate ourselves to the spiritual platform, which is where the real fun is. You know, Satchitananda. Your spiritual life is full of knowledge, full of bliss like that. So anyway, I think I probably ran out of time, so I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yeah. Ms. Shringa. The question was, since he didn't have the microphone, how much cable TV can you watch? Okay. Are there any Krishna conscious shows on cable TV or satellite TV? I've never watched cable TV. I don't think satellite TV in my whole life. It came in after I was already a devotee, so I don't know if I've ever watched it. But if it's not Krishna conscious program, I guess the answer would be zero. There are certain strict gurus that don't even allow their disciples to go on dandabat.com because it's kind of like, you know, but that might be taking it to an extreme. But yeah, if it's not Krishna conscious, none. Why watch it? Yeah, Chandrasekhar. It's the latter. So you have to understand, Vedic society, women were very protected. You know, a woman was under the protection of her parents up until she was of marriageable age, and then the parents would very carefully, you know, arrange a marriage with a suitable boy who came from a, you know, a good family, and then she'd be under the protection of her husband, and she'd be meant to follow her husband, not just anybody. I mean, she wouldn't have very much, if any contact with men other than her husband or her husband's relatives or her husband's friends, you see? So the woman is meant to follow a very suitable, qualified male who's been selected to be her partner and guide by other qualified people, quote-unquote, parents, very carefully, after very careful. Anyway, you get the idea. Go ahead. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, just for the sake of time. Yeah. If somebody reads Prabhupada's books, there's tons of, like, lots of instructions. I mean, the basic guideline is Trinadapi Sunichena Tadodapi Sishna. You know, so a devotee is not, you know, trying to be humble and trying to be the servant of the servant of the servant. So I think, you know, we have enough information from Prabhupada's books and lectures and letters and everything like that, that a devotee should be able to figure out how to behave appropriately pretty much in every situation, you know, without too much difficulty. But, I mean, it's a good point, but yeah, I don't think it's like something that should be too difficult to work out. Yeah, Archibald.
One female artist who was senior by initiation and by age to all the others, including Jadarani and Bharadwaj and all of them. But they were supposedly better artists and they joined the art department before her. But Prabhupada specifically wrote a letter that you have to treat her like a senior. She's older than all of you, almost twice your age, and by etiquette you have to treat her like she needs that by her position. Prabhupada spelled it out. So you have to take care of her needs. It's not Maya. Don't think that, oh, you're not this body, and why should I do it? No, she's a senior person. You should take care of her needs. You know, Prabhupada spelled out specifically how to deal with somebody in a senior position. This is part of Vaishnava etiquette. So again, the first one is by seniority, by initiation. Then there's age, then there's position, you know, type of president, whatever, within the society. Then there's varna and ashram. Those five things are there. And it doesn't say anything about sex in any of those five ways of determining seniority. It has nothing to do with your sex. Who was initiated first? You know, what is your position in the society? What is your age? What is your varna? What is your ashram? Those are the five ways.
Yeah, if you can't remember all that, you could just remember, you know, like it says in that Shastakam, they're just offering all respects to others and not offering, you know, not expecting any respect in return like that. Just that's a. Just, if when in doubt, just offer respect to the other person. And yeah, it's possible. Yeah.
In Kali Yuga, everybody's a sudra.
Mm-hmm.
And our only hope is to actually take up the mission of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and chant Hare Krishna. Now, Prabhupada does say that you should take on Brahmana qualities. In other words, you, in order to advance in Krishna consciousness, you need to become a Vaishnava Brahmana. So we need to take on the qualities of Vaishnavism. And all these other things are there, but, you know, who's qualified to really execute those? And who's qualified to really understand all those principles? I mean, you said a qualified husband. Well, what? Where's a qualified husband?
Well, qualified husband, the definition I was given basically is just somebody who's following the initiation vows and taking responsibility to provide a, you know, place to live and so forth and so on.
Yeah, so you can see that a qualified brahmana, okay, that person would become completely dependent upon donations. In other words, if they were actually a real brahmana, according to what we're saying, Vaishnava brahmana, they would just like do what Magrari the hunter did and followed Narada Muni. And that was, he gave up his profession. He simply sat at the Ganga. He chanted Hare Krishna and people would come and give him contributions for his existence. And Prabhupada makes in a lecture I heard also in the fifth canto, Prabhupada made a distinction of a brahmana householder. It takes no income. He just simply depends on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And whatever he gets, and that's how he exists in those terms. And you can see that's very difficult in Kali Yuga. In other words, if you and I went down by the Venice Beach boardwalk and we sat there and just chanted Hare Krishna with our wife, I don't know, we'd probably be in jail. We'd probably end up in jail with cuffs. And that would be the extent of it. Or you can, for that matter, practically just maybe in India you could do that. You could sit on Govardhan Hill Road and sit there. Someone would probably give you enough to eat for your subsistence. In other words, you might get enough rice and a chapati where you could live daily and you would just chant Hare Krishna. So, you know, I think that sometimes we get a little bit carried away in all this stuff, you know, in terms of what we think it is. But really, our principle is to utilize everything in Krishna's service. Whatever it is, we use it in Krishna's service. The minute that we don't use it in Krishna's service, then it's maya. If you have a wife and she's a good wife, if you don't use her in Krishna's service and the execution of this mission, that's not good. And vice versa. So, you know, sometimes, you know, just like we're living in the city, and it's a horrible place to be in the city. It's horrible. There's so many distractions, so many different difficulties. But still, we should utilize everything in the service of the mission. Cars, vehicles, houses, money, family members, whatever it is. And that's a perfection in Krishna consciousness. And, you know, man, woman, all this stuff, it only exists in our mind, really. If we use everybody in the service of Krishna, everybody will be taken care of, regardless of you know, what position you're in. Who cares? You can think you're some big whatever, but with the minute you die, whoever remembers you anyway? Who remembers you? You know, I can't even tell you all the Prabhupada disciples that died by name. I don't even know. I can't remember anymore. So really, you know, these things are there in order for us for some purification, to understand that we may have some nature. But really, our real nature is that we're really sudras, and we're just simply trying to become expert servants in the mission that Prabhupada gave us. We're simply assistants. We're nothing really big. We're not going to be anybody that's going to be in the Bhagavatam or, you know, some scripture. We're just going to be ordinary conditioned souls that really worked hard and gave up everything to support the mission of the Acharya.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, I think what you sounds like to me what you're saying is something along the lines of that more important than emphasizing trying to establish or any sort of a hierarchy or higher principles is more important to, that's there to some degree, but more important to try to just see that everybody's man, woman, old, young, everybody's favorably engaged in devotional service somehow, and then everything, you know, will work out.
That'll be all auspiciousness. One thing that I do know, what Papa had said many times in many lectures, we have to develop the Brahmana qualities, you know, like tolerance, cleanliness. These are very important qualities to develop. And by developing those qualities, one actually will make advancement in Krishna consciousness. And it doesn't matter who you are. Any man, woman, whatever. It doesn't matter. But to develop those qualities what is the most important function, identity. And everything else will manifest from there. And that'll be especially one's Krishna consciousness. And then we'll be able to understand how to utilize the principle, everything in the service of Krishna.
I mean, sorry. I didn't interrupt. Go ahead. You want to continue? Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. Did you want to say more?
No.
Okay. Just one super brief anecdote just came to my mind that, you know, when you get in, when you've developed those qualities, you don't have to go, like, people, even non-devotees become aware of it. I was just remembering I think it was 1967, Prabhupada was on this TV show. Some of the Prabhupada disciples might remember the Alan Burke show. And this guy was like, you know, it was one of these like talk show things. And he was famous for like really tearing up the people who came to be on his talk show. He was really, you know, if you kind of didn't have something, you weren't squeaky clean. Alan Burke was onto it. And he pointed out right in front of the whole television audience that, you know, you were kind of like off. But when Prabhupada came and he introduced me, he said, we have the pleasure tonight of having with us a real Swami. He didn't even know, but he could just, you know, he could appreciate that this was a real Swami, you know. So Prabhupada had the quality, and it was like obvious, even to Alan Burke, you know, which was interesting because he was normally very critical of anybody who came on his show, but Prabhupada just immediately honored him, you know. So I thought that was kind of far out, an example of like when you get the qualities, people, you know, you don't have to. Prabhupada commanded respect. He was perhaps, you know, the greatest example of somebody who commanded respect and didn't demand respect. Anyway, probably out of time. One last thing. Oh, such a noise.
The Brahmanas should be engaged, and Prabhupada was answering all the questions back and forth that devotees were asking. Mm-hmm. But at one point, one of the devotees asked, I think Hriyananda Maharaj, and he said, what about us? Where do we fit into this? He says, Prabhupada said, oh no, we're above that. Meaning, assuming that we're actually qualifying to guide human society. Mm-hmm. And so this brought to my attention in your nice explanation about in the beginning when you said, I want to explain this, first of all these issues, what's relating to us here as, because it's really broad if you go outside to, meaning what you were talking about, mm-hmm. the verse. And what I called to my attention was also that any imperfection that might happen in relation, let's say, to the women or to anyone not being followings, it's actually the men's responsibility when the Brahman is not really qualified. So this like it becomes a serious responsibility for any organization or any group, like including individually ourselves, to take action in this and be, you know, walk the talk. One time also comes to my mind, remembering that when Lord Ramachandra was exiled and Bharat, who was in charge of the kingdom, came to see him, one of the first things he asked, Lord Ramachandra asked Bharat, his younger brother, he said, how are the women doing? how are the old men, the brahmanas, are doing. So he was really concerned. So again, the responsibility of any imperfection in human society lays in those who have the knowledge. And that's why Prabhupada wanted to emphasize like brahmanas, qualities of a brahmana. So if we see anything in the women that we say, a neophyte person might think, oh, the women, they're not doing properly. Actually, it's us that we're not following.
Yeah, nice comment. Just because we're out of time, we should probably stop there and we could talk more outside. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam. Ki jai. Shri Prabhupada. Ki jai.